From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
What is innocuous and what is not? And just as important, how is the official supposed to know ahead of time, oh, the $100 gift certificate's okay, but the larger one's not?
Sometimes you get the money up front, sometimes the money you get the money later, and it really should make no difference whether the payment comes before or after if we're looking at a corrupt public official.
University of Michigan law professor Barbara McQuaid, once a federal prosecutor. Before that, the Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And we're going to discuss a case before the nation's high court dealing with corruption. It could have some implications for high-profile cases here in Illinois. Also, the governor makes a new hire for the Prisoner Review Board, and a reaction to criticism that the board has faced in recent weeks was behind this move. Those stories and more are coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Dave McKinney, a reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Dave, always good to have you back on the show.
No, Sean, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
So this Supreme Court case, you've been following this quite a bit, Dave, and I believe you listened to the legal arguments that were made before the court this week. So break it down for us. What are the real key issues here?
This is a case that originates out of Northwest Indiana and involved the former mayor of Portage, Indiana, near Gary. The former mayor, a guy named James Snyder, had been involved in awarding city contracts worth over $1 million to buy a couple of garbage trucks for the city. And after these awards were made and the money was paid to the vendor, he decides, because he's hard up for money, to approach this company that got the city contract and say, hey, I need some money. And in short order, the company decided to hire him as a consultant. I guess you put air quotes around that. And paid him $13,000 in cash. Well, that was enough to result in a federal prosecution accusing him of engaging in bribery. This case before the state Supreme Court is his appeal. And the argument is that the federal statute that was used to convict him only pertains to bribery that occurs on the front end of an official act, meaning that I have to take a wad of cash and hand to a public official and say, do this for me, and here's your money for it, in order to constitute bribery. This is something that happened on the back end of that, where the official act occurs with the awarding of contracts, and then money comes on the back end. And the argument Snyder, the former mayor, makes is that there was no quid pro quo, no agreement that that this was, you know, anything untoward. And it's what's considered a gratuity. And so there's a whole big debate now about whether gratuities are bribery or not. And that's what's before the U.S. Supreme Court.
So we heard Brett Kavanaugh in the open there for a moment. Did you take anything away from some of the questions that justices asked as far as how they might be leaning in this case? I know that's often hard to really determine and decipher, but at the same time, anything that stood out to you?
Well, I mean, you could hear the conservative justices especially, but also some of the Democratic justices expressing, everything from skepticism to confusion about how do you define corruption? That's at the heart of this, because you get into a realm, and Kavanaugh, the point he was making there with the reference to gift cards is suppose, you're the United Way the governor decides that he wants to hold an event at your headquarters, and then as a token of thanks, you send the governor a bottle of wine. Well, the question is, would that constitute bribery? And I think that's what these justices were trying to figure out. And the real reason that we care about this case, of course, is that it has great impact potentially on some of the big Illinois corruption cases that use this same federal bribery statute that now is in dispute. That means, of course, former House Speaker Michael Madigan, 7 of the 23 counts pending against him in his federal indictment are bribery related and tied to the statute. And then before that, the ComEd case involving the four former executives and lobbyists, they were convicted last May. There were 5 of 9 counts in that case that relate to this. So, you know, it's a situation where if the Supreme Court decides that this bribery statute needs to be, at least part of it needs to be gutted, then these cases in Illinois, the ComEd case, you know, it could be a situation where, you know, the defendants that were convicted might be able to be thinking about lesser prison terms, or, you know, if it's severe enough from the prosecution standpoint, there might have to be a new trial. And with Madigan, it's a question of whether or not the feds would have to re-indict, you know, and restructure their indictment. It's generally believed, though, with Madigan, whose trial starts in October, you know, they included enough other charges against him that it should not affect that case moving forward in a great deal. It won't undo it, but the feds might have to retailer their indictment in some way.
Now, Charlie, we've talked about this a bit on the show in the past because it's come up, of course, been working its way through the court system. You've weighed in on how you feel this may apply to the former House Speaker Michael Madigan's case. Give us your thoughts on it again.
There's a substantial portion of the case against Madigan would not be affected if the Supreme Court decides, yes, there has to be an obvious quid pro quo before the fact. So I would say the biggest jeopardy, if you want to use that term, for the prosecution would be in the case of the ComEd 4, when it's really not clear that there was that kind of a beforehand quid pro quo. It was more that we're going to do all these stuff and we hope that you'll be pleased with us, that kind of thing. It was interesting, some of the questioning from the justices, I think it was in your story, Dave, you mentioned how Justice Neil Gorsuch wanted to know, is it a sin? And if it's a sin, are we talking about, would it be a venial sin or a mortal sin? I thought that was interesting. And some of the other examples, gift cards from a boutique store or the Cheesecake Factory, or supposing I send a thank you note or send a gift card to my orthodontist because he did a good job straightening my kid's teeth. Or if you give a teacher an apple, does this fall within the bounds of the law? One of the reasons that the Supreme Court took up this issue in the first place is because within the circuits, there's a variance of opinion. Circuit judges in some instances have said, yes, there has to be an obvious quid pro quo before the fact. And others have said, no, gratuities are covered. My guess is that it's going to be limited and that it's going to be more focused on the quid pro quo rather than the gratuity.
I do think that there is going to be some action that they take with regard to this statute. I mean, you know, there's a companion law, I guess, that pertains to federal officials that engage in bribery when more than $5,000 is involved. And it spells out specifically that these types of gratuities after the fact fall within the broad realm of what can be considered bribery. The statute here is one that pertains only to state and local officials. And it's silent on that question of gratuity. And it's been interpreted, as you point out, Charlie, by different courts in different ways, but the way it was the way it's been consistently applied here in the Seventh Circuit is that because the one pertaining to federal officials spells it out, that's generally the way it's been interpreted here. It can happen on the back end, and so I think the court is going to take some action. I mean, it was also apparent beyond just the types of questions that the justices were asking. I mean, the lawyer representing the Justice Department here, you know, she was just grilled and was probably, you know, I would guess in front of the court for, you know, more than an hour answering question after question after question, while the lawyer representing Snyder, you know, was probably half that or less. And, you know, it's an important issue because, you know, our history and culture in Illinois is such that, you know, we've had such prevalence with this corruption, you know, not only with our governors in the past, with our, you know, members of the legislature, with the city council in Chicago. It's just been a continuous thing that even dates back to Al Capone, you know, where city officials are on the take and state officials are on the take. And so this has been a common tool that has been used really kind of as the last line of defense. We all know that, you know, the legislature has been, you know, almost, you know, glacial at the pace that it moves in policing itself in terms of tougher ethics laws and putting, you know, guardrails in place to try to discourage bad behavior. And it's really these federal prosecutors that are that last line of defense, if you want to call it that, where accountability comes into play. And so I think there's a, you know, for folks who are interested in good government, this case really is important.
Well, you know, it reminds me of the old, what was the legal definition from years ago about pornography? You know it when you see it type thing. You know corruption when you see it. I think the term gratuity, and Charlie, you know, feel free to weigh in on this. It seems to me that that term almost makes it sound like I'm sending somebody a fruit basket for giving me a big government contract, whereby we also see on the other side, a lot of times people will get on the back end some type of campaign contribution for supporting certain pieces of legislation too. So it seems to me like that even the term gratuity downplays a little bit of this and could make it a lot harder on prosecutors going forward.
Yeah, I think that, as I indicated earlier, my suspicion or my, I guess my guess would be that the Supreme Court is going to narrow the definition of what actually is illegal. And you mentioned campaign contributions, and let's say I'm someone who has an issue before the legislature and the General Assembly favors my issue, and then I give money to the candidates who voted for it. Is that corrupt? I mean, in one sense, that's kind of how the system works. You find people who support your ideas, are going to push what you believe in, and you try and get them elected. And part of getting them elected is giving them campaign contributions and continuing to support them after they're in office. So it's sort of a gray area. I think it'll come down, it'll go beyond to the fact that I say to Dave, hey, here's $10,000, do X, Y, and Z for me. But it will allow me after the fact to say to Dave, thank you for voting for my bill, and I will give you campaign contributions in the future.
And Dave, that has happened a bit in the past. Let's look back to Blagojevich, for example, about trying to hold up things in event to get money out of people, to try to squeeze them for certain amounts of money. So, I mean, like Charlie said, this is really a gray area, and maybe some clarity is needed here.
I don't doubt that there's some clarity that I mean, it would be helpful, I think. What you don't want to see happen, though, is having the court green light corruption, you know, and basically enable it to flourish more than it does. I mean, that's the key question here. You know, how do you and this is what the government lawyer, the Justice Department lawyer, was making. I mean, the argument that, you know, rather than gut the whole thing, maybe there's just some way to do a little bit of surgery here to clean it up a little bit. But yeah, you look at the fact pattern in the case in Portage, for example, and folks, I think folks, well, we interviewed a defense lawyer in Chicago that has been involved in several high profile federal corruption cases. And he's like, this fact pattern does not look good. If I was on a jury, I would convict too, because you've got a government official instrumental in awarding contracts, and then in short order turns around, takes cash payments from the same vendor, and there's no contract for services he's to perform. There's no evidence that he did any work whatsoever. It just was basically a cash payment. That fact pattern does not look good, you know. And it also kind of reminds me about multiple conversations that I had after the ComEd verdict. You know, I developed a bit of rapport with the jury forewoman in that case, and You know, hearing the way that that jury in the ComEd case kind of processed the facts where, you know, ComEd was, and these folks who were convicted were all part of an effort, you know, to give jobs, contracts, and other favors to allies of Mike Madigan in exchange for, they thought, helping advance the company's legislative agenda in Springfield. You know, there are a lot of people that weren't on trial in that case, but they had a stake in it. You know, all the ratepayers for ComEd had an intimate stake. You don't want to see something that makes public corruption any easier to do than it does, because it continues to be a pervasive problem.
All right. You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and WBEZ's Dave McKinney. Well, we will watch over the next couple of months or so. We do expect we may see the decision from this court on that case coming here by the summer. Well, let me turn to another announcement that was made this week, Charlie, and this was the governor naming a Prisoner Review Board executive director. Now, the board has had a chairman and, of course, board members, and they make decisions on whether or not people get released from prison, things of that nature. And, of course, they came under a lot of controversy here recently over the release of a man who is now accused of going just a day later to a woman's house who had an order of protection, or had filed for an order of protection against him, seriously injuring her and killing her young son. And certainly that put a lot of controversy, or a lot of scrutiny on this board, a lot of controversy from it. The governor reacting by naming an executive director this week. Tell us more about that, Charlie.
The governor named Jim Montgomery, who had been a director of administrative services with a sheriff's department in Massachusetts, but he also had worked as an assistant to Illinois lawmakers in the 90s, and he was a mayor of Taylorville from 1997 until 2005. And in announcing this appointment, the governor said that Montgomery is going to be responsible for overseeing the administrative board operations. And among his charges will be to bolster domestic violence prevention training. And this is a quote from the governor: other important equity-based training for board members. This is the first time the board will have had an executive director, someone to handle sort of the administrative duties, and that will free up chair of the board, reduce the workload placed on the chair so that he or she can focus more closely on casework. And part of it stemmed from the fact that, as Dave said, this alleged killer, Crossetti Brand, was released from Stateville despite allegations that he'd violated an order of protection against his ex-girlfriend. And the day after the board found insufficient evidence for him to be kept under lock and key, he attacked his ex-girlfriend, stabbing her, and he killed her 11-year-old son. And the thing that struck me at the time, alleged offender, Brand, initially admitted that he had gone to his ex-girlfriend's home, but he said that he was there looking for an apartment. He turned himself in, was taken back to Stateville because he was already on parole. And so this was a violation of a parole. But when this particular case came before the Prisoner Review Board, the panel, Brand denied going to her home. And he said that there was no evidence that he traveled to her home. And what struck me was that the woman herself was not called to testify before the board. And so the three board members determined, well, there's not enough evidence to corroborate her claims. As I say, it struck me, why would you not invite her to come and tell you in her own words? Why would you just take this guy's word when he has a history of domestic violence and he's been under orders of protection? And the judge in the case, who she had asked for an emergency order of protection a few days before this happened, saying that Brand had threatened her in text messages, he'd come to her home, but the judge didn't know. He believed that Brand was still locked up, so he ruled that the woman's request for an emergency order of protection, that he would set a hearing for later on. As a result, because there was this like lack of communication, the judge wasn't aware this guy was about to be released. Had he known, I'm sure he would have put out an order of protection and had the guy detained. So it was a real mess up on the part of the Prisoner Review Board. And one of the things that the governor, I think, wants to do is put somebody in charge of some of the nuts and bolts of the operations so that the members in the chair can focus more on what the issues are. And I think providing that they're going to get special training in domestic violence prevention would be a good thing.
Dave, this is it's not an exact science when it comes to granting parole, things of that nature, but you know, a lot of human nature that has to be figured in there. But at the same time, this seems like a pragmatic approach.
Yeah, I mean, it's an organization that or an agency that isn't always front and center in people's minds, and yet, you know, if you're the man or woman in charge of running our government, it's an agency you have got to keep tabs on. I mean, all of us graybeards here, we remember the 1988 presidential election and George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis were going at it. And, you know, Dukakis, when he was governor of Massachusetts, had a similar situation where a guy got paroled, Willie Horton, and went out and murdered somebody. And then that became the basis for a really damaging campaign ad that Bush used against Dukakis in that election. It kind of, you know, it's still remembered by people who study political science to this day. So for Pritzker, I mean, politically, we don't know what his plan is, if he's going to seek a third term or seek higher office. But this case here, because the Prisoner Review Board member in charge of, you know, deciding or recommending, I guess, to the full board whether this guy should be paroled was his appointee. So it's something that an opponent could easily turn in to some kind of damning political ad to use against Pritzker. At the same time, I mean, to your point, it's a, you know, being a member of the Prisoner Review Board, I think, I mean, I've known a few of them over the years, is kind of a thankless job. I mean, people do it out of a deep sense of duty, because, you know, there's some people who want to get into it because, you know, they have kind of a victim advocacy bent. There are others who are more, you know, kind of into the rights of the prisoners. And, you know, you kind of get that cross-pollination thing going on, but it often involves these folks, these board members, traveling to all the prisons in the state. And it's often one person, and then they report back to the full board, and then the board takes action up or down on these petitions.
And before time gets away from us, I do want to remember somebody who passed away this week, a friend to all of us, Lee Milner, and a lot of people knew Lee, both a state employee and then as a retiree. He also documenting many events throughout the area, always with his trusty camera. Lee will be missed. Charlie, you've known him a long time.
Yes, I think I first met Lee. It would have been in the mid-70s when he went to work for then House Speaker Bill Redman. He was his assistant press secretary, and he worked there several years, and he was a very gracious guy. He was always willing to answer your questions, and he always seemed to be upbeat. He was always in good spirits. Then he became the lead communications officer, like the press guy at the State Board of Education, and he was there, oh gosh, probably 20-some years, 20-25 years. And when I was director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program, one of the things that we did with my students was to have them go to the state board and meet with some of the people there so that they would be able to get a sense of what the state board did and who the people were. And Lee was always very helpful in scheduling those. He was just a really wonderful, kind guy, and I can't remember him ever saying a nasty word about anybody. He had a good sense of humor, and he is somebody who will be really sorely missed.
I got to know Lee back in the mid-90s, and, you know, his word was gold. He's over time, he was a source of mine on different stories. He was, you know, just a gentle soul. And, you know, early on in getting to know him, I learned that his dad was a Methodist minister downstate around Effingham, and had preached in a Methodist church in a little town called Montrose. And it's where my grandmother lived. And as I later learned, I mean, he was the guy who presided over my grandmother's funeral, Lee's father, which I hadn't put two and two together until the first few times that I had met Lee and then recognized the last name. And when he said Montrose, it's like, well, that there's an intersection there. But he, you know, he just conducted himself with such dignity and was a friend to everyone. And that's kind of the legacy he has. I mean, it's not often you see people decide to make a career in and around government the way Lee did, who in his dying days winds up coming to the Capitol and having the governor of the state of Illinois come down and pay a visit out of a show of respect. I mean, you know, there were, you know, Governor Pritzker after Lee's death put out a statement that just says he, quote, was heartbroken to learn of the passing of longtime public servant and celebrated photographer Lee Milner. He was beloved across the political spectrum and Illinois, a testament to his ability to connect with those he came in contact with through his lens. May his memory be a blessing. And then our colleague Dean Olson over at Illinois Times did a beautiful profile on Lee and quoted the former Illinois Governor Pat Quinn. Quinn called Lee a man for all seasons and said, quote, he's not a show horse or someone with braggadocio. He's a down-to-earth, caring person. I really, really, really enjoyed working with him. So, you know, just about everybody he ran into, you know, had a great experience with Lee, and he will sorely be missed. And, you know, I extend my condolences to his family and to his friends. I mean, we're gonna be without someone special on the planet with his departure.
All right. Well, let's move on to our notes from the field, and Charlie, we're gonna go to you.
All righty. Well, earlier this week, the Illinois Senate approved legislation that would ban certain food additives that have been found to be hazardous to one's health, and that you find them in common products, candy, soda, baked goods, things like that. The chemicals that are going to be banned include brominated vegetable oil, red dye number 3, propylparaben, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and potassium bromide. They would be banned from manufacturing beginning January 1st, 2027, and then the sale, delivery, distribution, and holding of products containing these additives would be banned beginning in 2028. And the argument is that these things have been linked through research and studies with all kinds of negative health impacts. And as a matter of fact, these additives are already regulated or banned in parts of the European Union. Now, the industry groups argue that, well, a state shouldn't do this. This should be up to the FDA, and the state has no business interfering with determining product safety. The Food and Drug Administration is looking at revoking authorization of this brominated vegetable oil after a study found that this chemical affects the thyroid, creating negative health impacts.
Well, that's all of the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Dave McKinney with WBEZ. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Don't forget to join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.